Well, what I'd like to say this morning is your affiliation with the University of South London. I'm also visiting Professor Dell. I've been so much time. I'd just like to remind you of how we had our program last year and a bunch of the basic questions that emerged, and I'll come back to that at the end of the talk, which I think might be interesting. As you know, our program there in Cambridge was very much funded by and supported by industry, and I think that led to some interesting aspects of turbulence. But what I'd like to talk from a sort of basic point of view this morning is a little bit about research that developed during that program, and I'll be reflecting on what other people did, eddy structures, dynamics, and particularly this business of the life cycle of eddies and how this relates to spectral models seen from a dynamical point of view. But I would also like to talk a bit about this question of spectra and interpretation of spectra, where there's an interesting kind of dichotomy in the turbulence community as to whether spectra are looked at as a distribution of eddies of energy and amplitude, or whether they are a signature of some particular kind of coherent structure. One of the most important practical outcomes of our Isaac Newton program, as seen from the industrial point of view, and I believe also from a turbulence point of view, was a sort of map of turbulence modeling and how turbulence research is going to be being applied. So we began the Isaac Newton program, as some of you will recall, last year, one of the most important sort of driving concepts of that was to what extent we could define the universal and the non-universal features and models of turbulence. And this is not just a general abstract problem, but an extremely important practical problem, because it relates greatly to the question of whether there is such a thing as a universal turbulence model for a wide variety of complex flows, and indeed whether one should even be aiming at that. And as I'm sure you've also been discussing, this relates to questions of whether there is some universal scaling of dissipation in terms of large-scale structures, whether there are structure-function relationships that are independent of large scales. And one of the interesting questions that we certainly raised, which was discussed, which still concerns many basic problems and applied problems, is the rate at which particles move apart. One of the great enthusiasts of this problem is Lachevec in Paris, and she said, "Would I go and talk to the government and the authorities in Paris next week?" But to begin the talk by talking about the Richardson's equation for the rate at which particles move apart, I'm not sure that will go down very well at that level. But it is actually still a very important question, and people argue about this two orders of magnitude, as you know. But the other important point about these sort of general questions, and I think that was once you've decided that turbulence is perhaps not universal, is then are there some interesting subclasses of eddy structure? And if there are subclasses of eddy structure, are these quasi-deterministic? Can we consider them in a quasi-deterministic way? And I think one saw some examples of that, and that's what I want to talk about. And the other very important question, and I thought there was an interesting degree of consensus about this, is as to whether or not the singularities of the fluid motion equations are significant. There was a good deal of interest about the singularities, and the question is how important they are in the overall aspects of fluid flow in terms of variances and mixing and so on. It is something that was discussed, and I think there was a sort of a feeling that they're very interesting, but perhaps not in fact significant in terms of controlling the whole process. But we might have an argument about that at the end. Now, the way I want to, the way I think about this, just to show you where I'm coming from before I get down to some maths, and I've got some a little bit of newish maths, is that I think we think about, when we think about the eddy structures of turbulence, one obviously thinks of them as a characteristic of the different flows, and secondly, they have different characteristics at different scales. At the very largest scales, one has structures associated with jets and wakes or curved shear layers. Then it's some energetic scales. One finds very coherent structures, sort of characteristic patterns with associated with shear or with small amounts of local convection. And these tend to be found in quite a wide variety of shear flows. So whether it's this flow or that flow, you would find where there's local shear, you might very well find the horseshoe vortex shear flow structure. Then the question is, if you come to the smallest scales, what kinds of structures are there, how do these evolve from one form to the other? And that's what I want to particularly focus on. Now, as you know, there are different points of view about this, and I always enjoy this slide taken in the in the physical laboratories in IBM lab. Obviously, couldn't use the computers because computers couldn't do the problem. So they actually went down into the lab and took some photographs of fluid flow. This was this nice paper of Schwartz, showing, of course, that if you look at fluid flow in one way, you see this tendency to form sheet-like structures. They may well be rotated. If you look at structures another way, you see this question of tubes. And one of the interesting debates over the last 10 years has been the relative dynamical significance of these kind of structures versus the kind of sheet-like structures that were particularly emphasized originally by Bechhoff, Townsend, and others. And I think the interesting point is that actually one sees both of them in turbulence. They're both part of some life cycle, but I think the results that we saw at Isaac Newton from the work of Occhitani is that by the time they've got to this point, much of the dynamical eddy transfer has actually ceased. So the way I want to analyze this is the following, is to follow along the track, of course, of many earlier workers, Townsend and indeed Bechhoff and so on, is by thinking within a turbulent structure, within a turbulent spectrum, what is the relationship between small scale and large scale straining? And Tony Leonard has been doing interesting work on this. And one of the points I want to discuss a little bit about, what about the background fluctuations that are not part of this local structure? And one of the features that you can see is that by doing this kind of analysis, as you see in Townsend's book, ages 99 to 100, if you're an aficionado, is that gives you an estimation of Kolmogorov coefficient and the strain and the energy transfer. But it does depend upon the notion of some kind of relaxation time. And I think one of the interesting points about the more deterministic studies, which Tsunoba and others have done, is that we begin to understand a bit more about what is this idea that there's a straining for a certain period and there's some kind of breakup. So the analysis of this, which I'm going to sort of maybe talk about the results, comes from this idea of the, first of all, a linearized approach, and then considering the nonlinear terms. So if you consider, and the point about the linearized approach now is that by understanding nonlinearity, we can, I think, generalize it and see a good deal more about its implications. If you take the Navier-Stokes equations and then you consider the velocity field as being some larger scale straining motion, some smaller scale fluctuation which you initialize, and you consider the vorticity of the smaller scales omega and the vorticity of the bigger ones big omega, then what we want to do is to consider how does the vorticity of these smaller scales increase as a function of the straining by the larger scales, and that's of course an old and classical approach, and when you ignore the effects of nonlinearity, you have what's called rapid distortion theory. There are still interesting and difficult aspects of that because very often, particularly when the large scale straining is rotational, and if it's non-uniform, there are still interesting discoveries being made about the way, for example, if the vorticity, this last year, the question of the vorticity of the large scale straining is very non-uniform, then you can produce tremendous non-uniformity in the local fluctuations. Another important feature, which I hasten to add because that's been my kind of activity over many years, is to focus on problems when the large-scale straining itself is quite non-uniform and the turbulence is non-uniform. You can still use linear methods for that. Some people talk about rapid distortion theory as just being a methodology that is only used when the turbulence is homogeneous and the strain is homogeneous. of the attraction of a linear method is that you can actually look at significant non-linearities, non-homogeneities. Now, the primary way in which this equation is used to look at the stretching of turbulence and the transformation of energy is by focusing on the situations when you've got very large straining associated with this being approximately irrotational, so you ignore that term here, and you're assuming that you can regard this as a locally homogeneous strain, and you look then at the rate of change of vorticity as associated with the vortex stretching term. Now, the point I want to comment on, and I'll just talk about this diagrammatically, is what happens when these nonlinear terms develop. Because obviously the vortices will begin to be stretched in some directions, they'll be compressed in other directions, and these nonlinear terms begin to be very important and dominate over the linear terms for certain components of vorticity, and they become, in fact, maybe even suppressed for other components of the term. And what I will do is to show you in a diagrammatic way this process, which, as it were, gives you in a rather more rational way, by understanding the growth of nonlinear terms, it gives you in a rational way a method of working out at what point the straining process has to be, as it were, stopped by what has hitherto been used as a arbitrary relaxation time or scaling relaxation time.
So generally small omega is much larger than large omega, is that correct?
This little omega will be larger than big than this big omega, but little omega will be small compared with grad u. So in other words, you're saying that the straining by the large scales is going to be more important. This term here is going to be considerably more important than omega dot grad u initially.
Yeah.
So this is the primary kind of straining process. Now, Tony Leonard's work last year was particularly what happened is if this was had a finite length of a size, so that when the particles began to be stretched, eventually your stretching of your vorticity becomes so long that it actually finds itself in, as it were, inhomogeneity of the grad u, which is also another way of actually reducing the rate of growth of amplification of omega.
Well, the linear stage is just kinematic dynamo problem. It's like magnetic field. It's like dynamo for omega, no?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the linear stage, it's a sort of semantic question whether you use the word kinematics, but the point being that as you say, that the rate of increase of omega is simply due, and in that sense, is quite correct. It's kinematics. It's increased simply by the same length as a fluid line element. That is absolutely correct. But that is not correct if you have a rotationality of the large scale flow.
Maybe inject something about that vortex stretching term and inhomogeneities on the large scale. You could get infinitely long vortex lines that just kept going on and on forever. And if those lines were sort of spread over space, those inhomogeneities would become important. But there is another alternative, which is as the vortex lines are getting stretched, they're also being wound up, so that you could have it being stretched, but it being turned around and around and around, so that actually you'll have infinite line length, but it'll never spread over all of space.
Mm-hmm. That's a bit like the Leonard as it were issue, as it were, when as it were, this is sufficiently non-uniform. That's right, and then that is another form of limitation of, as it were, of both spreading and indeed of amplitude. So, or we can come back to that. But anyway, so this is the sort of sense a key picture. By the way, these diagrams and some of these calculations are in my paper for the which took a bit of time to write, for this Isaac Newton book on vortex dynamics. Now this analysis here, in which we consider the non-linearity, the weak non-linearity, stems from this paper in JFM, Keflahan Hunt, 1997. Now, and a lot of work of other different people. Now, if you in fact you have a sort of a vortex. Now, the thing is, if you consider nonlinearity, of course, you then can no longer consider turbulence as some sort of arbitrary initial field, some arbitrary spectrum. You've actually got to consider particular types of packets, and that again comes back to the work of Tony as well. So we're going to consider two types of sort of packet or vortex structure. And let's consider one here, in which, in fact, as a matter of fact, the integral of U2 dx2 is non-zero. And if you take this sort of vortex ring-like structure, and it gets pulled out, two things happen to it. One of it, it gets pulled out, and each of these cross-sections here gets flattened here. And the whole structure itself gets turned into a sort of, you know, oval. Now, if we first of all look at this region here, you'll see then that because this is of a finite length, and that's very important, a finite size here, if that gets squashed, then we all know that a region of strong vorticity here, which is pulled out, a strip of vorticity, winds itself up on the end. Now, this winding up process is in fact a little u dot grad omega. It's not a vortex, it's not a self-induced vortex stretching process, it's a vortex induction process. So in other words, this vorticity here is inducing motion here, so this, as it were, rolls around. So you're beginning to see, obviously, a change. Now, if we start in the linear phase, and we've got some sort of linear vortex sheet, then you would actually have a sort of a spectrum, a local spectrum of that, of k minus 2. But the moment, of course, your vortex becomes a more complex pattern of this sort here, so that you actually have an accumulation point, if you were to look at the spectrum of the eddy, or the Fourier components, you would see that the exponent then would begin to change. It would be less than 2. Well, Moffat and Lundgren and others are going back, have shown, of course, that that begins to change the signature of the actual of the structure. Now, another feature of this, which is, I think, an interesting point, is that, in fact, as you have this induction process here, because it's actually becoming weaker. The jump of delta U across this is becoming weaker as it gets wound up. So the winding up process is, as you say, it's also a form of weakening. But it does also will be straining any deformation of any other surrounding small scale turbulence. So this would be in that sense, a cascading process. Now, the other. The work that people have done, particularly Arne Odo, spoke in some detail about this at Isaac Newton and elsewhere. And for some time, it is the question of using wavelet analysis of structures. And then if you look in wavelet analysis, and there's a paper by Keflahan and Basilikos and others, you certainly see, as you go into various regions of the flow, as it were, as it were, I would call it a complex structure. And of course, one of the still open questions is as it were some unique way in which you're going to get an answer that doesn't seem to entirely depend upon the observer and what he wants and so on. I mean, we have the techniques, but I think the methodology of doing that in a rigorous way is still open to us. So this is what I would call a constructive approach. I am taking something. I am showing you. If you do some calculations, these are some things you get. You sometimes observe them. That is not a rigorous deductive theory of turbulence, but it's a sort of an inductive approach, which I think many of us adopt. But the important point here is that the point I want to make, which Sinober has made a lot of very instructive comments about, is that part of the roll-up is not vortex stretching, but is vortex induction. And he, if I may say, makes a big song and dance about whether it's u dot grad omega or omega dot grad u. And this is little u dot grad omega, as it were, is inducing this. So in this process here, curl of u cross omega is non-zero. The other thing you have is, of course, is you have to have this tendency of bending up at the end. So all these processes in the end, as it were, are self-limiting to the vorticity. Now, the other, as it were, type of structure is one in which you have vortex stretching, as it were, both this way and this way. So the vorticity increases. But what is very interesting here is that the vorticity can increase in such a way that the non-linearities actually decrease. Now, one of the great things that Krakenman has often talked about is the question of suppression of non-linearity in turbulence. And one of the, which is where he derives in a statistical way, and Occhitani commented last year by comparing a kind of passive vector field and a dynamic field, he commented that very often there is this suppression of non-linearity. It's a kind of, you know, I would say a buzzword, it's a sort of feature of turbulence. But for those of us who kind of are deterministic fluid dynamicists with a sprinkling of statistical pepper and salt on top of us, sort of want to sort of see some examples of this suppression of non-linearity. The reason why this is very important in terms of understanding turbulence, at least in my view, is of course the striking feature of turbulence is that, just to come back to the original spectrum, is that, which I should have done that, is that if you take our spectrum here, and if you plot it on this spectrum, the spectrum of strain rate, the spectrum of strain rate has a maximum at small scales. This is minus 5/3. So in fact, as you're going down this spectrum, we're really doing something rather peculiar, because we know that statistically the smaller scales have got a bigger strain compared to the larger scales. But actually what we're doing is a calculation in which we're postulating this has got a larger strain compared with this. And so the question is there some part of the life cycle in which that happens? So the point I want to make here, which is worked out in some detail, and we've actually done numerical simulations in this paper of Kepler, Hahn, and Hunt, is to show that in fact if you start with a weak vortex, it's strained in a particular form, the non-linearity is suppressed, and in fact in this situation here you'll see that, as it were, u dot grad omega is zero and omega dot grad u is zero, you actually end up with a flow which is identically curl of u cross omega tends to zero. So there are flows in which the now, however, whether the flows are this sort or that sort, it makes a difference as to how high the vorticity can go. So what we're saying here is that the vorticity as a result of this can then be strained to be bigger than the strain rate.
Is that just like a jutting flat?
It is really, yeah. But we've got vorticity both in these two directions.
So what you're really saying is if you want to have some sort of energy cascade, that you have to have some mechanism for generating small-scale strains.
Yes.
And this mechanism that you're proposing here, just on large scales, only can't go all that, can't be the whole story.
Well, can you just park that comment? I just want to finish this. I want to make two more remarks, and then I'm very happy to open a lot of questions. The bottom line of this, as it were, is which I am very, if I may say, I am quite, if I may say, pleased with, and I now have just talked about, is that in the papers of Ruch and Maxi and Kida and Tanaka and various other people who've commented that whenever you strain turbulence, you end up with these sort of whirligigs, as it were, and the point being that in almost all the papers, they all attribute, whenever you've got a whirligig, as it were, to a Kelvin Helmholtz billow. And the point I'm trying to say is that in this flow here, this is a very precise deterministic calculation in which you see that the basic nonlinearity is suppressed, but it is unstable. So the point is that any kind of fluctuation here will grow. So this flow here, the growth of the smaller scales is a result of instability of a flow that's been made instability. So the non-linearity has been suppressed, but it has become more unstable. In this flow here, the non-linearity has been expanded. So it's simply deterministic non-linearity. This is what you call deterministic non-linearity. If I create a vortex sheet, it rolls up. This is non-deterministic non-linearity because I have created a flow that is unstable. And one of the big questions always in turbulence is does instability matter? It's one of the sort of, you know, sort of argy-bargy questions, you know. Have you got a low manifold, etc., etc.? So my point is that this element, and I think what's happening in turbulence, in straining, you've always got a bit of this and a bit of that. This is very important because this mechanism gives you very high vorticity, and the vorticity that can be larger than the strain, but it is also one in which it leads to instabilities. This one is one in which you get deterministic non-linearity. Okay, sorry. That's my sort of pitch, as it were. But Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just confused with the notation that says related to Rob's question. This little u is the small scale strain or large scale strain?
Little u is the small scale strain, small scale velocity, and little omega is the small scale vorticity.
Yes. So the statement that the omega is greater than small scale. I just don't understand that.
This does not follow from that. In this case here, while this thing is being squashed and strained, and then this vorticity here is being pulled out by this motion here, we are finding that the vorticity can keep growing in this idealized flow, mm-hmm. and there's no limitation on the growth of that vorticity in relation to the initial large-scale straining motion. So I can create, if I have a precisely the right geometry, I can take a vortex ring of a particular sort, elongated, and I can strain it, and initially the vorticity of the vortex ring is small, and eventually the vorticity of this vortex structure will be larger than the strain rate.
Okay, so this grad u refers to large scale.
This
strain
is big
rate
grad u. Yes, right.
Big grad u.
Big bay root. Sorry. We'll just get the.
And by nonlinearity, you're referring both to induction and stretching.
Yes, yes, all of it. I mean, that's why I've used the word curl, u cross m. So when in the literature, and this is Kida and Tanaka, and you see that in Rich and Maxi, they have this is as it were a kind of vorticity which has a very large strain, and it's a very, very considerable detail in the numerical simulations. You first of all see these sheets forming, and then you see these roll-ups. And the way he tended to focus on the roll-up pictures is that they always, whenever they see a roll-up, they say Kelvin-Helmholtz. But in fact, there are these other kinds of mechanisms, which, if you look at the pictures, I think are also taking place.
Other mechanisms for roll-up, or other things going on besides roll-up.
Yes. But the point is that the roll-up is a word that, as it were, can happen by two mechanisms. Right. So that's now then the next question is a repeat of where we are here, that we've got a straining mechanism and a roll-up mechanism, or possibly an instability mechanism. So you may have but both of those are a mechanism for producing tubes, vorticity and tubes. Now, one of the interesting points, of course, is once you've got these tube-like structures, two questions. How long do they last? And are they important in terms of further cascading to small scales? Now, in fact, I have a different picture here.
I'm a little confused about the definition of the tube. I would have thought that the tube is either the structure where vorticity is aligned with the stretching direction, that is when it is actively being stretched,
yeah.
or some quasi two-dimensional structure where you have this nice tube now aligned with more or less zero strain, right? It's sort of fossil tube,
yeah.
and then that thing will collapse into a sheet where vorticity is aligned with the intermediate strain direction, and that thing would proceed to roll up. So I guess my question is it obvious that these jelly roll vorticity has anything to do with sort of strongly stretching dynamics of filament formation? It just seems like very different.
I think the answer is yes. I mean, to your basically your question that Bechoff and many others have as it were commented that, and that was the point about the Occhitani kind of simulation, which he talked about, but didn't write down, was that my question is exactly your question, is the process of forming the sheets the critical process of transfer of energy to smaller scales, or is it in fact associated with this sort of tubing? And the point that he commented, although the tubes are there and then they last a long time, quite a long time, the bulk of the energy transfer to the smaller scales occurs at this process of the formation of the sheets. And in fact,
is that there?
Akitani.
On what basis did he say that?
Numerical simulations.
Because there's a long series of simulations by mostly the French people, and I've also done some where we've looked at the development of the vortex sheets from random initial conditions, and there's no energy transfer. You form sheets, and there's absolutely no energy transfer. Now, maybe once you have tubes, and around tubes, you can have energy transfer associated with sheets. But it has to be an interaction between sheets and tubes. Sheets by themselves have been convincingly shown not to yield an energy transfer. And I think if Okatani is saying that, he's got something else in his simulation, or he's just interpreted it wrong. It's just, that just cannot be.
Well,
the situation you have there is ideal for forming energy transfer.
Yeah.
You have this thing that's rolled up, you have the outside edges, there are a tube, and then right next to it you have a sheet. So that tube is smashing stuff into that sheet, and that could be a strong energy transfer mechanism. You could have something very much like what really happens. But just sheets by themselves.
Well, it's the sheet plus this. I mean, this is in this process here.
Yes,
it is not the process. It is not the process when this has formed a diffuse long tube. By the time it has formed a diffuse long tube, then which has been a lot of the speculation.
Yes.
Then the energy transfer
has not happened.
So this process here, there's a lot. I mean, as you see with this little object here. I mean, this process. This is the sort of core.
Right.
Of the energy transfer process, and the point was that he did a very very high resolution Taylor Green problem in which he started the solution on it. I haven't answered your question, though, have I? The point about this one here. Can I just about this of the intermediate eigenvector, which I'm afraid to say I've. Can I be boring and refer you to our paper, because it's inadmissible question, response, but the point being that there has been a lot of, if I may say, it seems to be slightly mystery mumbo jumbo about this question, intermediate eigenvector, because it's quite true that if you've got a tube or a tube-like structure, then the primary and there is some, as it were, straining taking place along here. That is actually the straining along the length is actually slightly weaker than the straining around it, and therefore the straining along it corresponds to this intermediate eigenvector, and that's the one where this dynamics is continuing, and what you see out of a sort of quasi-weakly nonlinear solution. So I don't see there's a big deal about that. The fact is, once you've got a tube, you actually get a lot of strain in this direction, but actually that's not very important dynamically. And I think. I'm glad you're a nodding head there.
It's been years and years of this thing, and it's
sort of slightly boring, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. we've gone on something interesting, right? So then the question is this question of if you've got tubes, and there are. So first of all, I think we. One believe, and I think I don't think terribly important in the whole scheme of things. But once you do have tubes and you've got structures around them, these tubes interact with the structures. And I've now done two sort of separate type of experiments on this. I mean, you see this mathematically. Originally, Melander Hussein did nice work on this. I think they got perhaps sort of carried away with their poetry, but I don't know. But they certainly we all agree about the first part of this, and Fazli has done this very nice work on the core dynamics to show how once you've got some exterior effects, it can then produce a variety of sort of waves and deformations of the core structure. So there is a process. A breakdown. We actually did some experiments on this, which was quite fun, which we actually had an oscillating grid. I'm sorry, it's rather a minuscule diagram here, in which we had spinning paddles in an oscillating grid, just to see really whether, if you do spin this up, you then produce sort of vortex rings here and this large ejection velocity, which people had seen in large eddy simulations, and indeed you do. If you can also do this by a linear calculation, a rapid distortion theory. You have some environmental turbulence, you get it's distorted, it forms rings like structures. And the point about these is that they have an induced velocity which travels up and down. And you see that in the lab. Of course, this was a rigid structure. It's rather fascinating seeing these rings form and then whizzing up and down. And I think these are the ones that that calculations of Miyazaki and Hunt and a variety of people have commented lead to some breakdown. Someone has a breakdown. Now, what I really wanted to get onto is all this stuff. Now, since I'm at this, make a mathematical aside. I mean, you've heard this before, I'm afraid to say, but the question of the difference between oranges, sheets, and bananas. Because what I've found in talking to people in this whole question is that we've now agreed that, well, agreed, the hypothesis is that we form sheets. Sheets roll up, you have tube-like structures, and then they break down, you're back to some chaotic structure, which might be like a hedgehog or an orange or whatever. Now, what is interesting is in the mathematical, as it were, description of turbulence, a lot of people use anisotropy coefficients, vorticity coefficients, but then they suddenly plunge into sort of pure poetic language about oranges and sheets and roll-ups and so on. There's no mathematical language for, in fact, these kind of geometrical shapes. And I've asked all sorts of mathematicians, can you tell me what is, you know, is it a banana or a sheet or an orange or a hedgehog? And I didn't get an answer. So this is my answer. And I think it's not bad. And it's in the spirit. It's in the spirit of maybe you. Well, tell me when I've explained it, you can tell me whether you've already done this. But if in fact, in many of these problems, you've got some sort of surface contour, which could be temperature or it could be vorticity. And it was a student in the Netherlands sort of puzzling over this that forced me to sort of try to give him advice. So I'm sure we could do something. And I looked at work of Sigier and Pumia, which sort of began maybe thinking. Now, if you take one of these surfaces, obviously if it's an orange or a hedgehog or whatever, you know, you can put a circumscribing surface. But if it's an infinitely long sheet, then you would have a surface, you take your surface above and below the sheet, and then you would do a cut on a symmetry plane so that there was no grad G on these other surfaces, and you did the same with the tube. And so you then define a vector G, which is minus grad theta, normal to the surface. And now this is the, as it were, the novel idea, which is you calculate the average of GI, GJ over the surface. And then you calculate the sort of anisotropy tensor of that. So you take the average of GI, GJ over GK, GK. Now, for example, if we take the case of a sheet, then the vertical component is X3, then sigma 1,1 and sigma 2,2, this is obviously zero, so that's minus a third. Sigma 3,3 is 2/3, so that would be the coefficients. Now, of course, this value of sigma 1 now depends on the orientation, depending if I have a different x-axis. So what I want to have is obviously a definition of my sheet that is independent of the orientation of my axes, and therefore I calculate, as we always do in turbulence and other subjects, we create an invariant. So if you take the second invariant and the third invariant of this average anisotropy tensor, which is taken over the surface and defined in this way, you then find that you start the sphere is zero here, a sheet is 2/9 and 2/3, and the tube is 1/36 and 1/6. So this gives you a method which we're now exploring with this group in the Netherlands, of, as it were, starting with some region of vorticity. And then when the formation of sheets would give you an indication that you're moving up here. If you were forming tubes, you would go here. If the tubes broke up, you would go here. So
you're working with some fixed vorticity cutoff or something.
Yes.
So it defines your sheets.
Exactly.
Yes.
Could well be. That's right. But the point being that what these students, as it were, or the workers in the subject keep asking is that what they want to do is to find some kind of more objective description of the sheet shape, and because the shape of the sheets is changing all the time, and they do all this sort of point-wise kind of math, and then they have to say, well, I'm now, and they go into this sort of qualitative language, and so what you would like to have is some kind of methodology for describing those surfaces. So the only person I know who sort of writes most about geometry or geometry of surfaces is Rika, Renzo Rika, and he thought this was.
Trying to distinguish star from apple.
The business of the point is that people said to me, well, what about an orange and a hedgehog? Well, the answer is, of course, is that this statistical measure is telling you something about the overall shape of it.
Yeah.
Quite a different statistical measure would be associated with telling you a local fractal. I think a local fractality.
The hedgehog of an orange. This measure, which is going to tell you the difference between an orange and a banana.
That's the point. You know. Not an orange and a hedgehog. And the fact is, there is no well-known. Anyway, now the reason why I was doing this is because I think this very interesting and important aspect of turbulence theory, turbulence development, is this work of the life cycle of turbulent eddy structures. Pumia has looked at this, and Sinober, and there's a paper in JFM by Ui and others, in which they have commented that if you look at sort of eddy structures, and I will show you, you can do this in a deterministic way, you find that there is a sort of process of looking at it in the second moment of the strain tensor and the third moment. Now the second moment of the strain tensor is the vorticity squared minus the strain squared, and the third moment is the sort of strain cubed plus the vorticity squared times the strain. Now, I'm going to give you the answer because time's moving on. The interesting thing about this is that, in fact, if you follow the method that I was suggesting, that you can understand things by considering small scale and large scale, you can actually replicate, it seems to me, the idea of Sinober, Ui and others by this sort of model problem. So when you start down here, you're starting with a small region with small local vorticity and a large strain, so you're starting with omega, Q is small, and the one thing we assume here is that we're starting with such that the strain has a negative skewness, so R is positive here. Then as Q rises, omega squared increases, so this term here becomes negative. Omega becomes larger, so this rises up here. And then we reach this sort of roll-up, break-up phase, and so we drop. So this is this kind of, as it were, objective method that's now quite widely used in the literature to try to, as it were, define the life cycle of these kind of structures. And I think, therefore, this is a quasi-deterministic way of understanding the fact that the life cycle structure corresponds to this straining time scale. Now,
in our experience, it was easier to think of that QR plot first decomposing into large and small.
Oh yeah.
If you like.
Yeah, well, that's what I.
And so similarly, this geometric measure is, in our experience, better defined. Not in terms of sort of microscopic contour,
yeah,
but in terms of sort of coarse grain field. So then, some of these questions about hedgehogs.
You've been looking. Yeah. Oh, well, I'm. You know, that's why I came here. You know, to find out. I'd be very interested to see how that connecting to your work, because it seemed to me such a much better way to sort of try to explain this stuff. You know, and obviously it seemed to me odd that it hadn't been. But what I wanted to comment on is sorry, this is a rather busy slide, but I will explain it shortly. First of all, I have to emphasize that the nature of turbulence spectra and structure have very important practical applications, and the engineering literature and the engineering kind of the way people talk about turbulence is if only thing that matters is one point statistics, and the classic case is this marvelous American disaster where they built a power station in which there was, this is a power station here, and they were cooling the power station in the desert by ejecting droplets, and the idea was that the droplets would come out, and as they went out they would cool in the environment and fall back into the pond and they'd be recycled. And when they did the calculation, that they assumed that there was certain momentum flux with this jet, and there would be turbulence in this jet, and therefore that the rate of transfer, heat transfer from the outside into the jet would be the same as if it was an equivalent jet. And they were out by a very substantial factor, and therefore the cooling rate was very much weaker, and they apparently lost hundreds of millions or billions of dollars on this project. And I explained, I was talking about this experiment here, and the Americans said, oh gee, now you explained, you know, why we lost so many hundreds of millions of dollars. But one of the things you know about, because I have been the chief executive, is that people don't go around talking about their disasters. If only they did. You know, we know about the Tay Bridge falling down, and we know about the Challenger and so on. And all these technological disasters are the most instructive things in engineering and physics. The trouble is, we only hear about a small fraction of them. Anyway, this was an extremely instructive disaster. But the point is that if you do the experiment in a slightly more controlled way, if you have a jet, you create a jet with droplets. You actually generate a flow, but these droplets are whizzing through the jet. They're producing small wakes, and you find then that in fact. That if in fact it's rather like this, if I got a spectrum like this of turbulence and I perturb it, and indeed this was an experiment in the 1930s, which you find in Hinzer, page 342, if you want to know, in which they were most surprised to find that if they put a small gauze, into a turbulent flow, they found to their astonishment that it reduced the diffusion rate. Because in fact what happened was that on this sort of shortish time scale, of course, you produce a small-scale turbulence, just like my model problem. Of course, the small-scale turbulence is amplified because it's taking energy away from the large scales, and the large scales are then are seeing a sort of super-eddy viscosity, and so immediately the large scales drop. So what actually happens is that you see this sort of rise here and a drop here. Over a long enough time, you'll then get back to some sort of curve like this. Now, if you look at any correct me if I'm wrong, but all the books that I have seen, all the models of turbulent spectra, you look in Lissier's book or EDQNM or any of these other ones, you will see that they are essentially quasi-equilibrium models of turbulent spectra. And if I put a delta function into the spectrum, the delta function smears out. It doesn't sort of produce a kind of big negative hole in the large scale.
For wave turbulence, there is a theory like this, and you know how this stuff propagates and how it disturbs the spectrum, but only for wave turbulence.
But I mean, this is not necessarily wave turbulence. I mean, this is what I mean. My argument is that this is
there is no theory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I produced an argument. I won't call it a theory. Not in this company, anyway. But the point being that I believe this is an example of how turbulence acts as in a viscoelastic way. You know, you take a bunch of putty, you hit it on the floor, it bounces. If you allow it a long time, you bleh. And this is the sort of the converse engineering problem, and there's a beautiful paper just to show you. Well, I want to emphasize to you that these kind of things are of tremendous practical importance. There's a lovely paper by Panofsky in the Quarterly Journal of Royal Metsoc 1982, where he was concerned with the problem of wind energy, which is, I'm glad to say, now beginning to be important in the United States and so on. How does a spectrum adjust when you go from a smooth surface to a rough surface, you see? And that's obviously a slow adjustment process. You're suddenly generating a lot of small-scale turbulence. But actually on a time scale that's long compared with longish compared with a relaxation time. And he actually derived a sort of, you know, called typical turbulence, statistical physics relaxation time model. And then the turbulence adjusted essentially on this time scale. It adjusted faster for the small scales and longer for the large scales. So my view is that the kind of typical modelling that one has in EDQNM or even in Kraken-like modelling corresponds to this sort of slow adjustment, the sort of viscoelastic side of turbulence, whereas there is actually the elastic side of turbulence is associated with this kind of process.
Julian, can you finish in 5 minutes?
Yep. So my 5 minute time,
okay,
I know.
10 minutes.
No, that's all right.
Unless the recording runs out of tape, right? It's a formal meeting, right?
Well, I just wanted to touch on this, because it does relate to this question in fact, it relates very precisely to this question. When we describe turbulence. And you see this in obviously the classical textbooks. The notion is that the spectrum of turbulence depends upon these a distribution of eddies or Fourier components. And Sinjin Lin, who was just referenced in Tony Lennon's paper, talked about vortex rings. So that's one, as it were, idea of turbulence. And the form of these doesn't matter very much. What matters was the distribution. And the other approach of turbulence was that it was really, as it were, a distribution of structures with a very coherent form. So my kind of summary diagram is, which I'll try and show you, is sort of like this, as it were. As it were, if you had a distribution of eddies or a set of spectra, all of which were independent, you could just add the two together and you could form any spectra you like. But what we see, of course, is that turbulence, at least on short times, interacts very strongly. So the other approach is to say, well, actually, there's a few major structures which have got a very coherent kind of pattern and a strong singularity, and these are what actually dominate the form of the spectrum. Now, what I was going to say was that I've developed because I've not seen this done mathematically, is a mathematical approach to this problem, in which what we do is we simply consider a distribution of statistically independent eddies, UN, and we form a spectrum here, and what we say is the spectrum E of K, it is an integral of a distribution function times the spectrum of the eddy function. By considering a sum of independent spectra and considering a fast roll-off or a weak roll-off, you find these very interesting results that as to under what circumstances, in terms of the space-filling nature of the eddies and the singularities, as to under what circumstances is dominated by B and what circumstances is dominated by E. So in the simplest case of a singularity of an eddy structure, as it were, you've almost got a delta function distribution, you've got one very characteristic eddy with a strong singularity, then of course the energy spectrum depends upon the form of the spectrum of the eddy times essentially the distribution of that most significant eddy. The converse is the work done by, as it were, introduced by Perry, which I think is, which I, well, I sort of feel I understand a bit more now, which is to say, if you consider this distribution around n minus n naught minus 2 beta, you'll find that there is a broad spectrum under certain circumstances, which we can define in terms of a scaling of the velocity of the eddies, a distribution function, and you say that the energy spectrum is simply determined by these exponents here. Not, it's really quite unrelated to the spectrum of the eddy. And what's rather nice about that is, if you then produce an argument, you'll see you'll get the, that in other words, that all the eddies have a similar velocity field, like these longitudinal eddies in the boundary layer. But their space filling seems to be strong evidence for that. You will get that the spectrum goes like K minus 1, which is now quite well observed for these long structures. Conversely, in 2D turbulence, where the velocity is proportional to, in some sense, the size of the eddy, the distribution, and Dritchell has done this space, looked at the distribution of eddies in his simulations, and you apply the same formula, you'll see then that you would get that 2P is equal to 3, which is, as it were, we know for certain types of 2D turbulence. The complex structure in that case, this shows you that the complex structure, because Moffat and Gilbert have suggested that the complex structure dominates the 2D turbulence. I think the answer is it probably doesn't. But anyway, this gives you at least, for what I can see, the first kind of hint of a methodology of going between these two kinds of classical argument in turbulence as to whether it is the eddy structure or the singularity of the eddy structure or the distribution that is dominating it. Well, I have lots of other things to say, but thank you very much.
you can continue the discussion. I feel like unless we need it for something else.
Let me remark. Yeah. Shri wants me always to remind about five other moments, and now I'm just playing my part.
Yes.
So, as far as spectrum is concerned, you may cook it up from you know, sheets, spirals, just mixing in different. What really tells you what's going on is a whole set of moments. Mm-hmm. Then, it is probably the only way to say which structure and which role played. Because as long as you consider perturbation functions, there are infinite number of ways to cook it. But as long as you have a whole set of moments and you consider at least a set of exponents, that's where we will tell you what are the structures inside and at least with what probability, with what measures they exist.
But, I mean, you know, there was a meeting here, in fact, at Santa Barbara, when my colleague Vasilikos, who worked on this problem, pointed out in 92 or 93 or something.
91.
I just had to read the proceedings because I'm doing other things. that indeed, I mean, you're right, I'm supporting your point, that if, in fact, if you look at these structures, I mean, in fact, the point he raises is that if the spectrum is dominated by the structure, the Kolmogorov structure function becomes very flat. You know, it's completely flat. I mean, if you took the extreme of representing it by a vortex sheet, all other moments would have that same form. No. So the interesting point is that it's somewhere in between, and that's what I think is very nice, as it were, which I think is sort of not inconsistent with the notion that actually there was a mixture of, in my new language, as it were, this sort of either viscoelastic or short-term, long-time structure. But I think. But I think, well, we see, it was Corsin, who I had this marvellous conversation with years ago, who said the trouble with, you know, turbulence is that we haven't had enough experiments to really test Creighton and like theory. He had one attempt at it. There's a paper in JFM by Kellogg and Corsin where they kicked the turbulence with a sort of delta function, but it was a disappointing experiment. And curiously, there's been very little interest by numerical analysis people to do this sort of kicking. Everybody keeps trying to look at sort of, you know, distributions, and I think we should kick things for different, on different time scales, different length scales.
That's theoretician dream, to have green function of turbulence. That's green function.
Well, yeah, but theoreticians have had computers for 20 years now, and they haven't been doing it, have they? What have they been doing?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I'm being provocative, but I do think that we will...
It is hard enough to get any scaling to get the scaling of high moments, right, numerically or theoretically. And the next question is: so suppose you know all, take Shelley's exponents. So what happens to kick turbulence?
No, exponents don't tell me what happens to kick turbulence.
Yeah, but there's more to life than exponents. There's more to life than exponents.
Because it will tell me much more in a way. And you know the way you kick, because you may kick it in geometrically different ways. I mean, your force, your international perturbation may be different because it's a vector field.
We have to put on this famous the famous proposal of which well, we're still trying to which Lozo is involved with of this experiment in the Netherlands, which we may get. There's quite a good chance of getting funded to do a very, very high Reynolds number turbulence. In this sort of closed container. One of the things we would like to do, you know, is to do some experiments of really high Reynolds number when we do perturbations, you know, kicking it. So this is the great flexible facility that we're...
Like the superpipe?
It's our own, the Dutch superpipe, that's right. Yes.
And what kind of perturbation will be?
Well, one of the things that we've thought about is different sorts of grids. You know, you got one grid and then you put another grid in. But nowadays, of course, what you can do, which Warhaft has done, is these oscillating grids, which of course is quite an interesting thing to do. And I think that may be a very useful way to proceed. We had a meeting in America in Chicago in October. People were talking about big new experiments in LES and simulations, and I think there was a feeling that these sudden changes and perturbations would be a good way to study more of the internal dynamics.
I think a central point is to somehow gap the bridge between the structural approach and the statistical approach.
Yes.
And one way to do so, one way which may help, is this SO3 decomposition. Because the SO3 decomposition also focuses on the structures to the flow, whether it's the Y to zero moment or Y to one moment.
The SO3, the one we're using three point.
No, this is
using rotational symmetry.
Using rotational symmetry and focusing not on the standard moments, but on the moments according to the SO3 decomposition. And this somehow may focus on different structures, because depending on what structures are the flow, different moments will have more or less intensity.
Yeah, I can't comment very intelligently on that, but I mean the word three does as it were trigger a bit, as it were, my response, which I do think that measuring the velocity with 3 points. I mean the point is, if you got 3 points, you can't still tell the difference. I think it is between. You can certainly tell the difference between oranges and bananas, as it were. But what you actually need four to be able to tell precisely the difference between where the turbulence is coming along in all those three types of shape. And I think Pumière and Warhaft are now looking at these three simultaneous measurements, which will help us a lot to understand about the structure. And the trouble is with turbulence, like all areas of science, is actually dominated by particular experimental problems, you know, using 2 points. If we'd had 3 or 4 points, you know, we might have been doing a lot more different theory.
Four is crucial.
I agree.
It's right.
Okay. I think that everyone here is sort of talking about the same problem from their own point of view. So let me give my own point of view of how do we go from this zoo of structures you talked about at the beginning, which has certain dynamical problems for getting anywhere. Mm. I mean, the point you made, and I was trying to give my point of view on, is that if you take a large-scale straining flow, the structures you get out just don't produce a small-scale strain, and something's missing. And then people take this jump to a statistical something or another. Everyone has their own particular statistical theory for what the end product is. But there's no understood way of going from the structure idea to the statistical part. And the best example of it, of the problems, show up in that QR diagram that you showed.
Yeah.
Where we know where the points are, and we know the direction that things need to go. But the only theory, simple theory, that takes you around in the direction that we believe things ought to go is things like these Vilfos models or Cantwell's model, which neglect important terms in the equations, and therefore have singularities that don't exist in reality. If you put in the terms that they neglect based on what we think the structures are, all the singularity stuff is suppressed, and you don't get what you want in the end. So my point of view of getting from the structure idea to the statistics picture, the thing that we are missing, and that no one seems to have the time anymore, including myself, to address, is how the structures interact in detail and yield a statistical state. We have lots of calculations of stopping about 1992 or something like that, of various types of initial conditions that develop some sort of structures, usually sheet-like structures, sometimes tubes. And then there's this gap where you have to just say, well, then it goes through some instabilities and you end up with a thing at the end.
Yeah, but we've worked all those steps out. I mean, the point, that's what I'm trying to say. If you're 1992, we've worked out.
They have not been worked out.
Well, some elements have been worked out.
That there is. What the methods you're talking about, the calculations that you do, are always dealing with some sort of large-scale strain, some large-scale flow that's forcing the small scale. There is nothing in the work that you do that really shows how the small scales get generated by themselves. If you have a small scale there, it's generated by, and then you have a large scale, it'll do things to the small scale. But you're stuck with a finite amount of strain at the small scale. You're not injecting stuff directly into small scales that's going to give you what you need.
That's one of the reasons. I don't know whether you agree with the terminology. This is the point that I was rather pleased about thinking about. This is the question of instability. One of the vexed questions of pure deterministic nonlinearity versus, in some sense, instability of the structures that are formed. And my point being is that there are situations when you've actually got to, the curious thing about instability, you've actually got to create a situation which is quite ideal for an instability to grow, as opposed to the whole thing just being pushed and pulled by everything else all around it. It's actually got to be quite an ideal. I mean, you certainly see this in in triggering instabilities in other flows.
But I don't see any demonstration that those instabilities are strong enough, develop enough energy strain, whatever, to start bringing energy to the small scales and really produce the small scale structures in a reasonable amount of time. There's just everything I have read has a limitation.
This work on these tubes, I was talking about this Miyazaki and so on. One of the very striking thing about that was the time, because it went through all the time scales. You have a tube, you have other garbage around it, it spins it up, it breaks it down. It's incredibly fast. I mean, the time, we worked out the time scales for that. And in fact,
you have an initial tube there already. What if the initial tube, the small scale tube that you want to put something around, isn't there to begin with?
But it's a. Well, this is the argument. The argument is that it's come from
there to begin with.
But it's come from a previous part of the cycle. It's a cyclical process. That's the argument. I mean, I'm wrong, but I mean that's my argument. Is that you just keep going through all these things and
look at the mixing layer.
I mean, I don't disagree with the picture.
You've got a board of shape and it rolls up, and the rolls roll up together, and they make small scale structure.
Right. If you take the close look, those processes are always controlled by the time scale of the previous process, which is a long time scale. The stuff at the small scale is not generating its own small time scale to do anything.
You want it to?
You do, yes. If you don't, you're stuck always with each cascade step taking longer and longer and longer.
I agree with you. It is a very critical question. I mean, I agree with you. This is one of the sort of key questions is, because you do cascade things bloody fast. I mean, you know, in
you do.
It is an incredibly fast process, and therefore one of the things I've looked at in these various kinds of sort of idealized problems is whether, in fact, it is consistent with this very fast cascade. And I've sort of been encouraged by that, but maybe you have not been encouraged. So we need to talk about that more. Sorry, you.
I think a rather happy marriage of these various ideas of the bouncing is possible. Right, there is Vieffo's flaw in that invariant, you know, phase-based invariant is very suggestive. It is, but it certainly is not periodic.
Oh yeah.
It's an open phase-based flow, and it's an over.
Simplification.
They've been emphasizing at great length that null locality is important there. Mm. The stretching and formation of the tube is initiated by non-local interactions rather than stretching, non-linearity, etc., etc. But the problem with that picture is that. It is looking at the local gradients, and then by the time you take into account what you shouldn't have neglected, things change. And on the other hand, it leads to singularity, which you don't want either. But if you reformulate it on...
You mean the roll-up? The roll-up is a singularity.
Well, it isn't really a roll-up that's a singularity there, but it is stretching. Stretching the sheet, right?
It will keep on going.
It has the two
information of the feedback mechanism.
Assumed or derived.
By making
isotropic pressure recognition. But anyway, now if you try to apply that line of thought to coarse grained blob type of a thing, then you have reason at least to neglect the viscous terms.
Yes.
But in addition, you have a shape that you have to keep track of, and it's another dynamical object in your theory.
Yes.
Then you also have an opportunity to go beyond this isotropic pressure approximation, right? Because you have that. So that picture would
of course, be more complex, because in addition to this RQ variables, you have another dimension, mm-hmm. and it would be right to the shape tensor. But I mean,
maybe wrong, but what I was sort of arguing was that, and there's one thing I want to do, is to see whether my kind of, you know, G, my invariant, you know, actually corresponds going around that loop. I mean, that's obviously...
Well, you won't get going around the loop, but you will have
some
connection.
Some part of the story. You will have other sure. dimensions, and then what interaction with them, what really makes it, I mean, not infinite in a finite time. I think it's a good time to hear you to talk again, because my feeling is that the message is through and
only
a couple of hours.
That's true, isn't it? But going back to experiments, it would be, it's very difficult to measure, full gradient tensor locally.
Yeah.
But the argument would be, doesn't really have to be. It would be equally interesting to measure velocity.
In non-local geometry, there's also non-local dynamics, and I mean some measure of non-local dynamics in a suitable way. I mean, you could, that's sort of what you're saying.
But it would be interesting to just measure, three or four velocities. In the inertial range, that would be wonderful.
I hope I haven't made the wrong remark, but in our summary of the Isaac Newton program, this seemed to me a rational approach. This one, we're moving from two to three to four, as it were, dynamics, and that's complicated enough. Whereas, of course, the concept, if I understood correctly, of Procaccia, was to have a frame moving on one particle, moving in a sort of, it's a fractal path, and then looking at other ones around it, which seems much more difficult, conceptually and mathematically. It's quite a mathematical challenge to sort of start moving in terms of three and four particles, but I believe that's going to be the most hopeful way of.
So maybe in a Delft experiment, it would be possible to set up a multi-point velocity measurement rather than.
I think we obviously need three is clearly looking interesting, and I think we should get the four.
Well, no, 3 points is enough. Yeah. If you can put in three probes, you're done. But they have to be velocity probes.
What I recommend that we continue the discussion but formally close the interview if you want to leave our attention. Thank you, Julian.